Brownfield's Bill ready?
Thank you, by the way.
Oh, you're welcome.
Do you have any tension?
Jody, I'm doing something very important.
The House Committee on Revenue for February 8th, 2016 will come to order. Colleagues, I want to let you know, Representative Helm and colleagues, I'd like to let you know that we're going to carry over until Wednesday the hearing on House Bill 4035. So if you're here for that bill, you're excused, and I apologize for that, but we'll go over until Wednesday. We're going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 4146. Remind us that this is the bill that would have the effect of increasing the state transient lodging tax. And we're going to continue with the panels that we had available on Friday, but we never got to. And since I first checked, there's been some names added to it. So let's hear from Randy Tucker, Elizabeth Edwards, Jeff Miller. Thank you so much for agreeing to come in today instead of Friday. And colleagues, we have a lot of work to do today, so I'm going to try to limit presentations. One of the things that we usually have done in this committee, we did not do on Friday, was ask you not to read your testimony, but instead to give us the high points. The members can read the testimony. It's in OLIS. They can read it, and if we can keep it brief, we'll be able to finish our business today. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I think the way we've planned it, my testimony is a little bit longer and Elizabeth Edwards is a little bit shorter, so I hope you'll forbear a little bit. And I have not submitted written testimony, though I'm happy to submit some afterwards if that's helpful. As you know, Metro is the elected regional government of the Portland metropolitan area, and in addition to the responsibilities that have to do with land use and transportation and natural areas and all those things that you know about, we also own and operate several large visitor venues. We own the Oregon Zoo, we own the Oregon Expo Center, and most importantly for this conversation today, we own the Oregon Convention Center and operate that. And we also operate the Portland 5 Centers for the Performing Arts, but Portland owns it. The Metro Council supports the effort to identify funding to support the 2021 World Track and Field Championships. We're proud also to be hosting the 2016 Indoor World Track and Field Championships at the Oregon Convention Center next month. We also support using transient lodging taxes to fund a portion of the 2021 event. However, the Metro Council does not support permanently increasing the state transient lodging tax by 1% as proposed in House Bill 4146. We believe that permanently doubling the current tax rate and devoting the new resources primarily to state leisure tourism marketing will harm the state's ability to continue attracting lucrative convention travel and convention groups. In the Portland area, we already have the highest transient lodging tax in the state of Oregon. We spend these dollars very carefully based on a highly articulated set of agreements between local governments in the region. And among other things, these are the funds that support travel-related, tourism-related investments in tourism-related facilities in the region. This measure would increase our tax by another 1% and make Portland less competitive as compared to the other cities with which we compete for convention to attract conventions. In addition, these new revenues wouldn't be spent attracting conventions or on improving visitor facilities, and those are the two specific needs our region has. I'd like to talk for just a second about this group business, this convention business, and how important it is. There are a number of important components of tourism in Oregon, and one of the most important is group travel, bringing in out-of-state convention groups. Metro manages the convention center, and we work closely with Travel Portland to land between 30 and 40 large groups a year. Conventioneers spend more money per capita than leisure travelers, an average of over $300 versus about $150 a day per capita. The convention center has spurred $5 billion in visitor spending since it was opened in 1990. That it represents an average of about $200 million a year, and in recent years that number has been much higher. In 2015 alone, convention business generated over $500 million, $538 million in direct and indirect spending just in the three-county Portland metropolitan region. That translated to $7.75 million in state taxes, income, lodging, and corporate taxes, and another $16 million in local revenues. Another reason that conventions are important is that most of these groups come in the rainy shoulder seasons of October, November, February, March. These are the times when our hotels are not otherwise filled, and when our hotels and restaurants and other tourism-related businesses really need the business. By contrast, in the summertime, our hotels are generally full. Now, as Representative Nathanson said last week about the 2021 track event, people coming to that event will travel the state and they will enjoy all the wonders that Oregon has to offer. The same is true of convention visitors. They often tack on days before and after their visits here to visit the wine country, the coast, Mount Hood and the Gorge, central, eastern, southern Oregon, the valley, et cetera. And so just as the track event attracts statewide travel, so do conventions. In order to attract all these convention groups, Metro and the City of Portland and Multnomah County and Travel Portland need high-quality facilities and resources. We use the transient lodging tax to write down the cost of group business. Every group that receives transient lodging tax to bring their group here must meet a return on investment standard of $25 in local spending for every dollar of subsidy. And that goes up to $40 in the high season. What we need to sustain and grow our group business is more funding to ensure we have state-of-the-art facilities and resources to attract group business. And with all due respect, that's not what Travel Oregon spends its resources on. In our meetings with Travel Oregon around this issue, they've been very clear that they're not in the business of attracting group travel. They're in the business of marketing individual travel. From our perspective, doubling their budget with a doubling of the state transient lodging tax won't move the needle on the very lucrative group business that we're in the business of supporting and attracting. It's a really important tool to attract tourists here in the rainy months when we need the business, and it'll make it more difficult for us to make the investments necessary to support this business in our state. As I mentioned, we have the highest transient lodging tax in the state. There's a little bit of headroom above that we feel that we can increase the tax without dramatically undermining our ability to attract groups and in comparison to the other cities that we compete with. But with a 1% increase in the state transient lodging tax, that headroom would be gone. As I'm going to get to in a minute, we will be supporting some amendments.
Yeah. And if you could wrap up, that would be very helpful.
Sure, sure. So I'll just get right to the amendments. There are two amendments that have been submitted, the Dash 2 and the Dash 3. I'll start with the Dash 3. The Dash 3 would be a four-year, 0.5% increase in the transit lodging tax. It would sunset after 4 years, and that would raise over close to $22 million, which is about what is needed to support the track and field event. The second proposal is the Dash 2 proposal. That would increase the transient lodging tax 0.5%. It would be permanent. It would use 15% of the overall revenues for a competitive grant program to support investments in tourism-related events and facilities, including sporting events. This is in addition to the 15% that is that the bill already calls for to be distributed to the regional destination marketing organizations. So for the first few years, this would raise enough money to cover the track event. And this second proposal leaves everyone better off than they are today. It funds the track event. Travel Oregon would have an increased budget on day one. The regional destination marketing organizations would see an increased budget that is also more reliable than they have today. The grant program, which you could think of as Connect Oregon for Tourism, provides a resource with which communities around the state can take advantage of opportunities to attract significant tourist spending. And most importantly, our region would retain the headroom that would allow us at some time in the future, which is a point not too far off in the future, to increase our tax by up to a 0.5% in order to support investments that would attract more tourists to our region, investments in facilities that we would need to bond against those revenues in order to make those investments. So while the Metro Council can't support the bill as introduced, we urge you to amend the bill with one of these two amendments and can support either of them very strongly. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Edwards on behalf of the City of Portland, tremendously appreciative of the opportunity to testify today and to Representative Nathanson for bringing this concept forward. Similar to Metro, while we're supportive of the intent, we have concerns about the details of the bill. I think first and foremost, it should go without saying, but Portland is extremely supportive of the 2021 Games. Next month, as Randy alluded to, we are welcoming athletes from all over the world for the 2016 Games, and the City of Portland has committed almost $2 million out of our general fund to help make those games a success. As Randy also stated, there's an issue of headroom. By moving the statewide transient lodging tax up by 1%, that puts us at 15.5%, which leaves us at a competitive disadvantage with other cities in our area, and I think Jeff might be able to speak to that a little bit more. But when we're looking at facilities like the Oregon Convention Center, Veterans Memorial Coliseum, Portland 5, Centers for the Arts, perhaps building the James Beard Public Market, these are tourism-related capital needs that the statewide TLT doesn't get at for us. But with the ability to raise our own tax, we could bond against those dollars and actually have facility needs that could be met at that point. That's why, as Randy alluded to, we have a compromise approach that would raise the statewide transient lodging tax by 0.5%. It gets the 2021 games what they need, and you could either sunset that or you could have a permanent 0.5% increase, and with the competitive grant program like Connect Oregon in the transportation realm, for those of you that are familiar with that, it would create an opportunity for communities to come in and compete for facilities needs, which is what we're really looking at in the Portland area. With that, I'll just thank the committee for the opportunity to testify. We remain willing to work on this bill and to continue to create economic opportunities that benefit the entire state, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Jeff Miller, the CEO of Travel Portland. We're here to strongly support House Bill 4146, amended to 0.5% and in perpetuity. This is a position that we've held since we learned about the bill June of last year. We've always been supportive of the 2021 Tracktown event and its long-lasting statewide impacts. We see a benefit to increase in Travel Oregon's budget, and that 0.5% increase would increase it their budget 50%. The current that we've talked about, the lodging tax going to 14.5% to 15.5%, there is a real desire by meeting planners to understand their tax burden, and we book, Travel Portland books, over 250,000 room nights just on the meeting side of the business. Those meeting planners can take their business elsewhere, and when you look at our competitive set of cities, we would be at or above all of those, which is not where we'd like to be. 40% of the lodging tax in the state is collected in the urban region of Portland, so it's a significant amount, and we don't want to damage our ability to grow that business. We did have a meeting with Vince Porter in June of last year to talk about our very real concerns about this, and he said he would gather a group to talk about that. It didn't happen until the City, Metro, Clackamas County, and Travel Portland met with Orla and Travel Oregon in October and in November of last year to try and find a path to either lessen the tax to a 0.5% or to have some local control. We were told that it was either 1% or we were killing the bill. So no compromise was available. We don't feel like our legitimate concerns have been addressed in this bill and are supportive of the 0.5%. Portland does have its own tourism infrastructure and event needs, just like Hayward Field and the track event. Expo Center in North Portland continues to operate with 90-year-old buildings and is a huge economic driver for that part of the city. Veterans Memorial Coliseum, as you well know, is in dire straits, and we've worked with our city, county, metro funding partners on what we can do with those buildings, but there is no sufficient funding stream, and this additional 0.5 headroom might give us that. The Travel Portland Board, which includes 11 Portland hoteliers, does support raising the tax 0.5%. That half-point increase would give Travel Oregon an additional $118 million over 10 years and $330 million over 20 years if the tax continues to increase at a 6% rate as it has. Significant marketing funds would be made available, and infrastructure needs would allow us to address our own infrastructure needs. We certainly do not want to impede our ability to book this very valuable meetings and convention business by pricing us over our competitive set of cities.
Thank you. Questions? I hesitate to raise it, but I'm going to. Amendment-2 says, administered by the commission to make awards for tourism-related facilities and tourism-generating events, including sporting events. Is there a definition somewhere of tourism-related facilities that we're using for the purpose of this amendment, or do you know?
I do not know.
I don't know.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, that was an attempt to be in keeping with the rest of that statute when talking about tourism, regional cooperative. Okay. The regional cooperative program is related toward tourism. The Oregon Tourism Commission is related toward tourism, so we were freelancing a little bit, but that's what that language was related to.
I don't want to open a tangent, but I just don't see a way of avoiding it. In 2003, when this issue came up, we heard a lot of testimony when Representative Shetterly was the chair of the committee on the need for facilities in especially the beach towns, the coast towns. I'm thinking of Seaside and some of the others. I don't remember the exact cities who were testifying then, but they needed to upgrade their sewer systems and their policing systems, and some of them were facilities and some of them were services that don't have a completely obvious connection to tourism, except that the population of the city doubles when the tourists are in town, and therefore the sewer system needs to be double the capacity of the normal sewer system. Would that be a tourism-related facility, as the way you interpret the bill, to upgrade the sewer system to accommodate tourists?
Chair Barnhart, under this reading, I would say no. We're looking at a more in-depth version of this particular amendment that would go into greater detail, but I don't think we had a lengthy conversation back in, I believe, 2003, as you alluded to, about the preemption on local government's ability to spend funds a particular way. And in talking with Orla and Travel Oregon, that's a conversation for another day, but it's something where
you've made it a conversation for today by putting in this amendment.
And that's why we had included tourism related in order to try and continue to keep with the conversation in 03.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as the requester of this amendment, I would say that this was an attempt to acknowledge some of the testimony that we've heard publicly, as well as I've heard privately, about the Oak Ridge, the mountain biking trail, and the idea that they need support and to be able to use funds to support issues like that. So that certainly was that was my intent in this language.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think we'd be happy to take a look at how tourism is defined elsewhere in the statute and see if it has a definition anywhere. I see a lot of mention of the word tourism, but not a definition in the statute in this bill, but it might be somewhere else. Jeff may know the answer, or somebody else may know the answer.
I think happy to work on that. That would be welcome.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for this panel?
The point is that the overall goal, as Elizabeth said, is to focus these revenues on generating tourism. Generating tourist activity, attracting people to Oregon, and to spend money in the tourism market. So,
very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Wendy Johnson, Jim McCauley, Eric. Looks like Kanzler, perhaps. then following them, we have Mr. Youngblood. And is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on this bill? Okay. Okay.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. As you know, Oregon, the Oregon League of Cities represents all 242 of Oregon cities, and tourism, we know, is a vital part of our economy for many of our cities. And so we support economic development tools, and tourism tools are, of course, one of those. And many of our cities are really excited about this event. But there's always a but. We're concerned about the distribution of the funds that are in this bill. Section 3 is the part that has the distribution part. It would try to ensure a 15% distribution back to locals, but we're concerned that that language doesn't quite get us there. Other taxes, as this committee knows, that are state taxes that are shared with locals are very specific on how that allocation happens. So the gas tax, the cigarette tax, the liquor tax, they're either paid monthly or quarterly, and we know when we're going to get them. And there's an assessment by the DOR or the Department of Administrative Services, and that payment goes out. This one just seems to have too much flexibility for the Tourism Commission of when they do it and how they do it. Most of it's done in rules. And so we would ask for an amendment that really focuses that and makes sure we know we're going to get paid, and that 15% really does happen to the regions based on a proportion. If that makes sense. We have basically two principles that the league is looking at for the distribution. We're looking for assurance that it will really happen and more will go to locals, and two, that there's flexibility with that distribution to the locals. So the two proposals that we would make are, one, to make sure it's more like state shared revenue to regions, and second, we'd ask for a grant program that's has some more contours. There's an existing grant program in the statutes right now, but it's funded sort of at your will. The legislature can appropriate money, but there's not a stream. And so we would like to ask that you not only make a 15% in statute clear that it will go to regions, but also make 15% with a competitive grant program. You heard testimony on Friday of how monies are distributed presently to regions. Some testimony said as high as 10%. We don't think that's true. We think that 6 to 7% is what's happening now. And so with this proposed tax increase, we need to send more back to locals. And so we're asking for the 15, which is sort of already in the bill, but we want to make sure that method happens, and then add the grant program. When I looked at some survey data to see how Oregon compares of how much we spend on tourism budgets, back in 2012 and 13, we were like 20th. But if this tax goes up, we're going to be towards the top of how much we spend on tourism. We just think we need to be prudent with our dollars and send more of it back to the locals. And we need to look at that tourism budget as a whole, because this 1% or 2% is added on to the local tax. And on OLIS, I provided you with the local jurisdictions, how much they provide in taxes. And cities and counties can impose what they want. And in fact, unlike other taxes, cities and counties were the first to impose a transient lodging tax. It was not the state. It wasn't until 2003 that the state imposed a tax. So you'll see on OLIS under my name the list of taxes, and our taxes range from 2% to 13.5%. So that's on top of the state tax. And when you look at the columns, you'll see what the tax rate is and then how much we've been getting each year in those various districts. So if you go down to like page 3 or so, it starts listing out each county and which cities have these taxes. And so the records, this is the Dean Running Report that Travel Oregon uses as well. You'll see that for many cities, they've literally doubled how much we're getting in revenues from 2003 till up to the present. And those of you who have been around this building and revenue committee know that in 2003, the only way this bill passed to create the Tourism Commission and the 1% state tax was that the Lodging Association required that locals be preempted. So what that means is, we're just kind of like property tax, wherever you were, you're frozen. And while we recognize that this bill does not allow us to look at local because it's a state lodging tax relating clause, we would ask that in the next session you would take a look at that, because the state is putting in dollars for tourism, locals are too, and we're not getting to look at that local portion at all with this bill. So the only thing I can ask for you now is to look at how you distribute the state tax. But in the future, we would ask you to look at that. We know that there has to be some compromise. Some cities got a great deal of how much they were putting in towards tourism, might have been almost nothing, and so they can choose what they want later to meet their community's needs. But other cities were locked in at a much higher rate, and they may have other needs. They may have potholes and roads and water issues that their town may be full of tourists, but they actually have infrastructure problems. So we need some flexibility on that, and we'd ask that you look at that in a future session. But for this bill, it's the two issues, the grant program and making it sure that there's a real distribution that we can count on for financing and predictability. Cities took in, if you look at the total at the very end, or add it all up, cities took in $87.7 million last year. And then when you add in the counties, it was $136 million. And so that's the part that we'd like you to look at in the future. There's some great other great things in this bill. It takes out the word marketing and focuses on tourism. We think that's a good change because it takes all kinds of pieces to make tourism work. That's a great change. There's another issue that we want to look at long term. Some cities aren't even on this list, and only about half the counties are. And that's because it takes a lot of work to do this administration of this program. And so we'd like the Department of Revenue to be able to do that for cities and counties that want to impose the tax. Maybe they don't have the staff or whatever, but they don't do it now because, one, 70% would have to be directed to tourism. And for others, they just still don't have enough staff. So in talking with the Department of Revenue, that's something they can do. Since now the state collects the tax on all, the state could enter into an intergovernmental agreement with cities and counties that wanted to have the tax collected. They're in a better position to enforce, and so we'd like you to look at that in the future as well to help with auditing, enforcement, and we also need to track better records and share with between each other. Right now, we're not allowed to share information between the city, county, and the state. So there's some more work to be done in the future, but for now we just ask you to look at the grant and the distribution. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Jim McCauley here representing Washington County today. I think I'll narrow our comments down to really just the core of the issue for us. Washington County is silent on the actual rate, whether it's 0.5 or 1%. Obviously, a higher pot or a bigger pot of revenue being generated means that more would be going back to the locals, and I think our folks would probably rather have more of that revenue coming back in. So getting down to the specifics, right now the distribution or what's physically in statute is the up to 15% that goes back to the DMOs, the seven DMOs that are geographically laid out on a map. We're part of the Greater Portland DMO. Along with Clackamas County, Multnomah, and Columbia County. The financial officer or the entity that handles that money is really Travel Portland. So none of that money physically comes in to Washington County for the Washington County Visitor Association to spend at all. It goes straight to Travel Oregon, and there is a committee that's in place that has the directors from each of the other organizations out there to try to figure out how to spend it. And historically, it's been spent on international travel and things of that nature, which is fine. But honestly, moving forward, especially with this type of a tax increase being bumped up, the need for us is not marketing and it's not promotion, it's facility use. And I think the tourist-related facility question that you brought up, Mr. Chair, for us really talks about an actual facility that would be built, improved, or enhanced to physically attract more visitors to our area. So in our case, we've been looking at a right-sized type convention facility in Washington County. Actually, the largest, the only facility capable of handling more than 300 or 350 people in Washington County is Nike. So there's no public facility that is able to take on that type of a role. And that's just just an example. I think the city of Beaverton is looking at a performing arts center at some point in the future, and I think they would look at that as being something closer to what they're after in terms of a tourist-related facility. So as you go forward in this conversation, it will be helpful for us to better understand what that distribution will look like at the local level and have some kind of a commitment in there so that at least for the increased, if not the whole pot coming forward, there is something that goes back down at the local level, at the county level specifically, so we would be able to prioritize that revenue source coming in. I think when you look back to 2003 versus today, back in 2003, probably didn't have as many robust visitor associations or tourist-related facilities or programs at the local level. We certainly do today, and that's part of what our local tax goes to support. So that's really all I have with comments, and I appreciate and would be happy to take any comments.
Thank you. Does that mean you support the Dash 2?
I just saw the Dash 2, Mr. Chair, and I think
we'll give you a chance to think about
yes,
it.
Yes, please.
Okay, please.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler, representing the City of Bend. So the City of Bend is not supportive of the bill as drafted, and, of course, that position has nothing to do with holding the worlds in Eugene, which we think would be amazing. The problem we have is a little bit different, and Wendy touched on it for a moment, but I'd like to go into it in a little bit more depth. So doubling the state TRT indefinitely for the purposes of supporting tourism isn't something that is really of interest to us. What we really need, what the City of Bend really needs, is not more money from state tourism, but rather flexibility in how we use the revenue that we do receive. And I'd like to paraphrase a statement from a city councilor made in a recent discussion on the topic that I think will highlight to a degree how we feel about this. If the state thinks we need to spend more money promoting tourism in Bend, we will have to put a sign outside of City Hall saying, please leave your torches and pitchforks outside. They will run us out. So why is that? Growth of tourism, as with any industry, of course, has impacts. And we've promoted the heck out of Bend. We certainly will continue to do so. Those efforts have been wildly successful, and they've brought many wonderful things to Bend. But those impacts, the impacts of the tourism industry, are being felt strongly to the citizens or by the citizens to the point that they're really starting to express stronger and stronger concerns about the city's ability to address them. And we share those concerns because due to the restrictions in state statute, as our revenue rises, we're forced to use it in the same prescribed ways. We can't have a conversation about tailoring that revenue to the problems we're facing at that point in time. This goes back to the 2003 discussion, of course. So, for example, the City of Bend has about $400,000 in unexpected revenue from lodging taxes sitting in an unused account with Visit Bend, and we've had discussions locally about whether there ought to be a rainy day fund for that money. And quite honestly, a rainy day fund for tourism dollars, when our transportation backlogs are roughly $80 million and our infrastructure is aging and costs are escalating, is not going to be the first thing on our list. So we think that we really, you know, this is, I think, a rainy day fund of that nature maybe highlights from our perspective why we would like to have a continued conversation about this in Salem. And so, you know, we understand that this isn't going to be directly addressed in the bill. It is a concern that has been brought up, certainly not just from the City of Bend. I don't even know. I couldn't sit here and say that we're going to pursue this in some fashion this session. We certainly want to pursue it as part of the ongoing conversation about this issue. We would love to talk deliberately about this in the interim, and we'd love some additional attention focused on this heading into the 2017 session. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Do you have amendments that you're proposing? That you've raised several issues that are not covered in any of the amendments we have. I thought Mr. McCauley's comments were aimed at the Dash 2 amendments, but maybe not. So,
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, we really just started engaging on amendment potentials and have just been in discussions with some legislators on this issue, so they're not ready for the committee yet. But as I said, they would really be focused on those two issues, how to distribute and modeling on a shared state shared revenue model, and two, locking in the grant program to make it specifically that it would happen. And I also just wanted to add, because you were asking questions about the tourism definitions, the statutes already have those definitions laid out. It's in 320.300. There's a whole list of the definitions. So tourism is defined, and tourism-related facility is defined, and they are broader than they were at one point. But I think the amendments that Portland has raised are using those definitions. The suggestions I've made on the grant program would be equally as broad to make sure that we cover facilities, tourism promotion type expansion, so that we're not just focused on marketing. It would include facilities or events, right, but not just conference centers.
You're aware that the bill removes the word marketing.
I am. Sure.
You're aware. Okay.
Yes.
The other comment I would have to that comment that wasn't responsive to my question is that this is a wrinkle and a rather complex one that could be added in 2017. Did you want to comment?
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, if I could, I want to make sure the committee understands that we're working with the principal carrier of the bill, Representative Nathanson, and we've offered some language to at least try to get us there. We realize that we may not be able to get to the detail that I think we would like before the end of this session, but if we can at least get some kind of, I'll say, a promissory note moving forward that we can work on those details before 17, because I think ultimately in order for us to get there for support, because there's no opposition at all to trying to raise revenue and to attract this World Track Championships. There's no question that would be an impact and value for the entire state. So that's the last thing we want to get in front of. But at the same time, with this type of a revenue bump, I think there's a way to carry on this kind of a legacy well beyond the next 4 or 5 years when the track championships comes and goes and we move on to other elements that could benefit the rest of the state.
Appreciate that clarification. Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I wanted to note what Mr. McCulley just actually said, and that is that Rep. Nathanson has been working with, I know, Washington County and probably others too, to try to come up with something that addresses good concerns that people have raised while still enabling this important funding source to hopefully move forward in the short session. With possibly a promissory note to address more of the details between now and 2017. So I think there's reason for optimism.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much for
Thank
your
you.
Testimony. We appreciate it. Mr. Youngblood, and I have Scott Youngblood on my list, and the man in the corner whose name I don't know, put his hand up. Please come forward.
Clark, Ms. Kennedy.
Jim Austin from
Clackamas
County.
Oh, Jim Austin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it would be useful when you have materials to present to the committee if you brought them in ahead of time so they could be put in the materials folder. Please.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Youngblood.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, I need to begin by apologizing because I'm nervous. It's the first time I've
You're allowed to be.
Well, thank you. I may refer to my notes more than I would like to.
And if you would state your name for the record and then give your testimony, we would appreciate that.
My name is Scott Youngblood. I'm the general manager of the Embassy Suites Hotel in Tigard, Oregon. Uh-huh. I'm addressing you today as the operator of one of the state's largest hotels, an enthusiastic and dues-paying member of Travel Portland, the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, the newest member of the Oregon Tourism Commission, and far and away the largest generator of lodging tax revenue in Washington County. Not to counter the point Mr. McCollum just made, but I think we had more than 300 people at the Beaverton Mayor's Ball on Saturday night at Embassy Suites. I'm here to lend my support to this legislation as someone who collects lodging tax dollars for our cities, our counties, and our state, and who really understands the potential and remarkable impact that this legislation can make on the lives of Oregonians like those with whom I work and play every day at the hotel. Increasing our state's investment in tourism doesn't just bring tourists. It brings accelerated investment in businesses and jobs to Oregon. My company, our development office, is in Manhattan. It's where the bosses are. And they've disproportionately devoted capital to my hotel in Oregon because of the investment that it represents. Plugging $12 million into a renovation that's wrapping up right now represents to them and many others the fact that Oregon operates at the vanguard of destination development, and they're voting with us with their investment dollars. The successful execution of the 2021 World Championships is just an example of what we can accomplish when sensible investment happens here. It codifies our leadership position in international tourism, and it makes possible further destination development, whether it's in the Gorge, along the coast, on Mount Hood, if it promotes ecotourism, bicycle tourism, rural tourism, all the while proving that we set evolutionary trends in travel and tourism, even as we watch other states scramble to mimic our practices. Almost done. You already know how responsible tourism contributes to the vitality and diversity of our small communities across Oregon and makes Portland the mecca it has become. You read it in travel magazines, you see it on television and in the movies, and you hear it from friends. What a unique and remarkable place our home is. Many of you have firsthand experiences with the Welcome Centers in Ontario, Klamath Falls, four tourism information centers in the Columbia Gorge, and those throughout the Willamette Valley and the Portland Metro. And of course, you know the myriad reasons why celebrating and protecting Oregon as a destination is both an honor and our solemn obligation. In supporting this investment, you're supporting big ideas and a bold vision for Oregon. You're promoting our regional destination management organizations so that they may realize stability and lasting security with predictable funding, increased flexibility in the administration of those funds, and the increased support of a statewide agency, which makes us proud to carry on the legacy that so many great Oregonians have before us. I'm really appreciative of your time today. I appreciate your consideration, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk at you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Austin, representing Oregon's Mount Hood Territory, which is the destination marketing organization for Clackamas County. I've provided late, I apologize about that, some testimony from our tourism development chair, John Erickson. He was here on Friday but was unable to be here today. Now that there's some amendments on the table, some of my verbal testimony may change a little bit, but in a sense, in that written testimony I provided, he provided a some of the concerns that we have with House Bill 4146 and the full 1% being proposed. I'll touch on some of those concerns. I won't go into them because you now have them in front of you. I'll let you read them on your own and at your leisure. But I would like to share with the committee before I do that Oregon's Mounted Territory is a destination marketing organization that offers what I feel is kind of a unique perspective. We, of the seven regions in Oregon, we are a member of three of them. We're a participant in the Greater Portland region. We are a participant in the Mount Hood Gorge region. We're also a participant in the Willamette Valley region. And our sort of perspectives in each of those regions is unique. In Travel Portland, in the Greater Portland region, clearly Travel Portland is kind of the big fish, and we're kind of a second-tier partner. It's the largest RCMP program there is. Conversely, there's the Mounted Gorge region, which is the smallest, and in that instance, we're sort of the big dog. We act as financial administrator and coordinate the programs with all of our partners. And then in the Willamette Valley region, we're sort of a middle fish in a middle-sized pond. So we kind of get the perspective from all sides. Being that we're a neighboring DMO to Portland, we acknowledge that Portland is a considerable draw that brings people into the state. You know, and sometimes it's appropriate for us to take that second-tier role. For instance, if we're presented with an opportunity to pitch to a group of LGBT writers and bloggers and ed board people from the Netherlands, we're not going to try to fool ourselves and, you know, try to trump Greater Portland and say, well, what you should do is really land in Portland, bypass Portland, and spend all of your time in Oregon's Mounted Hood Territory. It's appropriate in that instance to be a partner and say, what we can offer is, you know, more full-rounded package, right? You know, spend a couple of days in Portland and then maybe spend some time in a vacation rental up on the mountain. So in that regard, we'll take sort of a second-tier partner approach. With that said, we're also, with Mount Hood in our backyard, we're also a primary destination attraction. So, you know, in certain instances, we promote ourselves as such. So with that said... we do have some concerns with the bill. A lot of those have been articulated by other people here today. In a sense, the 1%, the compression effect that it creates for the city of Portland, they're a primary partner for us, so we don't want them harmed in this. We get some benefits. We do get some benefits from events and activities, meetings and conventions that take place in Greater Portland, both in terms of spillover, capacity selling events, but also what I call the bleasure bump, people who will show up for a conference or a convention, either show up early, do a little bit of personal travel, or do a little bit of personal travel afterwards. And I would argue that that bleasure bump spills out across the entire state where there's a destination attraction. So I've already mentioned that we're concerned with the competitiveness, but that sort of is addressed with one of the amendments, the 0.5% that addresses Travel Portland's needs. We're supportive of that. And reducing local options for self-help, it addresses that. And also, I'd like to touch base on our support for inclusion of the concreting the position of the RCMP program at 15%. We see this as a very valuable tool. We get together with our regional partners every year and put together a plan how we're going to spend those funds, what markets we're going to access, mm-hmm. And it gives us a little bit of ability to address some markets and audiences that we wouldn't likewise be able to do on our own. So we see the value in that sort of collective approach. We see a little value in taking our portion of those jelly beans and just going off on our own. It provides for an opportunity for a collaborative process that we see a considerable benefit to. So mm-hmm. I think that about concludes it without just reiterating a bunch of things that other people have said. I'll answer
any
questions.
And we don't have time for that.
Okay, so I'll stop talking.
We do appreciate that. Any questions for this panel? I don't see any. Thank you both very much, and you did very well.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, and with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4146. Colleagues, I expect a work session to be scheduled very soon on this bill, and we'll see what amendments we have available at the time that that comes. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 4043. And while we're hearing about the bill presentation, if you could hold your conversation till you're outside, that would be helpful. Thank you. Could we have John Van Landingham, Martha McLuhan, and Sybil Hebb come to the witness table? Go ahead and tell us about the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4043 has probably a dash one amendment on the way. It's been requested. However, it's not yet in OLIS. And the measure would exempt the proceeds from sale of a market rate rental housing to a community development corporation or a housing authority from capital gains tax. And this would be for years January 1st, 2017 to January 1st, 2020. Also, the introductory version of the bill increases the recording fee from $20 to $30 for various for filing various types of documents. And it also increases the limit on transfer fees paid to a city or county. And that's just an overarching limit, but the actual fee would go to $30. That would have a revenue impact of approximately $4.1 million a year to various housing funds. The dash one amendment would remove those fee increases and simply have the exemption from capital gains tax included in it.
Okay. Do we know where the dash one came from?
Yes, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Representative Kenny Geyer, and she introduced the original bill, didn't she?
Correct.
Okay. So I take it then that you want to testify to the dash ones we don't have yet.
Yes, sir.
All right. Now we know what we're talking about. Go ahead.
John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid in Eugene. The three of us and others have worked with Representative Kenny Geyer on a package of issues to support affordable housing. This bill is one of them. The amendments will remove one of the two issues in this bill, that is the proposed increase in the doc recording fee. So that is not going to be in this, that is not going to be, as far as I know, in any bill in this session with regard to affordable housing. I don't know about other bills, but the affordable housing advocates are not working with any legislator to increase the document recording fee. So if there are people in the room who came to complain about that proposal, that's not this bill.
You mean those who might be opposed to it?
Correct.
Yes, and of course the others.
There are some people who are opposed to that, that's not going to go forward with this bill or any bill as far as we know. The other aspect of this bill that we are here to testify in favor of is the capital gains exemption for sales of market rate apartments to nonprofits or housing authorities to use for affordable housing. It's a concept that was suggested by Representative Parrish in one of the interim House Housing Committee meetings, I think in December. I think she probably borrowed it from the Manufactured Home Park Advocates, which is me. And it is there, a concept which has been very successful. It was first adopted in 2005 on the suggestion of a bill introduced by Representative former Representative Jerry Krummel from Wilsonville during the mobile home park closure crisis. And that capital gains exemption applies to sales of manufactured home parks in Oregon to resident co-ops, nonprofits, and housing authorities. It's been renewed by you, by this committee, with an extended sunset in 2007 and 2013. As your staff said, the current sunset is 2020. It does not have a significant revenue impact on the state, but it probably has been used less than a dozen times since 2005. And it's been used by CASA of Oregon, which works with residents to help the residents buy the parks. One of those parks is up the McKenzie River in Representative Barnhart's district, I think, and also by St. Vincent de Paul, which is a nonprofit that operates in Lane County, has bought five parks now, two in Oak Ridge. It's very significant for that purpose. So it's not used commonly, but with an appropriate project, it's very significant, and we're thinking this is an important tool that might also help with us in preserving existing apartments. That's the concept. Pretty simple.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here, just to briefly echo Mr. Van Lanningham's support. And from our perspective, we have offices across the state in Coos Bay, Ontario, Portland, on the coast, in Klamath Falls and Bend. So across the state, we're hearing the lack of affordable housing is the number one issue impacting our clients. And so we think this is an important tool that is targeted to really help nonprofits and housing authorities have a little bit more bargaining opportunity in making this purchase, and will help us preserve some and maybe even add affordable housing stock to the state. So we really appreciate it, and hope you will support it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm with Northwest Housing Alternatives and speaking here today on behalf of the Oregon Opportunity Network. You have a letter in your packet of support from the Oregon Opportunity Network for this provision. I wanted to speak just briefly to it. My agency has acquired now 12 buildings that are preservation properties. These were properties that had an affordability commitment to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, but when that affordability period ran out, the owner had the option to sell for any purpose. They could convert the building to market rate, convert it to condos, bulldoze, do whatever they wanted to do. So we've worked very hard to preserve those buildings. In all of those cases, we have been purchasing from for-profit owners. Some of them very sophisticated. Six of those properties we acquired from an owner who was able to give us a discounted sale price because in return for a charitable contribution because they were selling to a nonprofit owner. But in other situations where the owners were not as sophisticated in terms of navigating that, this kind of provision would be very helpful as a negotiating tool. As you know, affordable housing is a crisis across the state. And as you know, affordable housing has a very complex piece-by-piece toolkit of how we acquire and then subsidize and then preserve properties for affordability. We think this tool could really help in a couple of situations. I am negotiating right now with a seller, a widow in her 80s, who has been a small owner of just these three properties for a number of years. And her biggest concern right now is taxes, being able to say to her that there is a way to address some of her tax issues is something that would be very important to her. Another strategy that's been discussed recently about affordable housing is the opportunity to acquire things that are naturally occurring affordable housing, properties that have not been subsidized by anybody in the past, but at this point just serve a lower income population. If we have the opportunity to acquire those properties, bring them into a restricted use, and ensure that they'll be available as affordable housing for generations to come rather than rising with rents in the inflationary market, that would be really valuable. What we need really is just an incentive to negotiate with these sellers, and this could be a great tool for us. We know it's worked in the manufactured home parks. We think it would be valuable in the affordable housing in the multifamily setting as well. And with that, I think we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just trying to understand. We have a really tight housing market where properties are really expensive, okay? So you stated that there's no loss of revenue to the state through this. My question is, why would anyone sell their real property for less than it was worth in this housing market unless they weren't going to pay taxes to the state? I mean, you made two statements there that don't comport. They are going to pay less taxes by doing this. Those taxes come to the state. So what we are doing is benefiting large sellers, if you will, of real estate to short our state. It's how I see it anyhow.
Yeah, could you go over that again so we can understand it more clearly?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, I talk too fast. So if that's what you heard, I'm sure that's what I said, and I didn't mean to say that. I meant to say that there is not a significant loss of revenue to the state. There is some loss of revenue because you're exempting capital gains tax, state capital gains tax, corporate or personal, for the sellers who sell to these special entities. The special entities in this case would be a 501c3, a charitable corporation like St. Vincent de Paul in Lane County, or a housing authority. Every county has a housing authority. Those are entities that would preserve that housing as affordable. So the seller would get a capital gains break, and there would be less revenue paid to the state, tax revenue paid to the state. My point, though, was it's been used less than a dozen times in more than 10 years for manufactured home parks. So it's not going to be used very often. It is very important in that context. It has been very important for the parks that we've helped St. Vincent de Paul buy, or we've helped CASA organize the residents to buy. So it's an important tool, just not used very often. We don't know how often it'll be used with apartment buildings, and you're absolutely right that in Portland it's a little worrisome that the cost of those apartment buildings is going to be so great that even with a capital gains break, the seller's going to sell it to somebody who can pay top dollar instead of Martha McLennan. But it may allow Martha McLennan to compete to try to buy that building and preserve it as affordable housing so that we don't have to replace that affordable housing, which would, if we do try to replace it, would be even more expensive to the state. So I didn't mean to say no revenue loss. There would definitely be some revenue loss. We just don't think it would be huge, and we're not sure how effective it would be with market rate apartments. But it's a tool. Representative Parrish said, why not try it? We said, sure. She's right. It works with manufactured home parks. Maybe it would work with apartment buildings.
Yep. Follow up?
Yes. It seems to me that the taxpayers would be in the highest income tax brackets that would take advantage of this. So, in effect, you're subsidizing the people who should be paying their capital gains taxes on these properties at the expense of the rest of us citizens. It just seems to me that we're singling out somebody who has the wherewithal to own giant apartment complexes and saying you don't have to pay these taxes, the rest of us are going to. It's just a comment. Thanks.
Thank you. I think to finish the answer, it would be useful for you to give us some more specifics about how it is that this particular tax break has actually been useful in dealing with these examples that you give us. I think I have an idea about that, but like Representative Whitsitt, I'm a little puzzled about how this actually would work and how this benefits the purchase price in a way that leads to the other benefits you've already told us about.
Okay.
Please.
Oh, I thought you were asking me to go get that information. Yes, I will go, Ms. Chair. I'll definitely go get that information.
Oh, okay.
I can't give you the numbers off the top of my head.
Okay, all right. Yeah, thank you. That I don't know that I was insisting on numbers. What I'm really trying to understand is the chain of logic. And the piece you left out by simply saying it has been of great advantage to us is several little steps in that one spot. It's been great advantage to us in those purchase of those 12 mobile home parks. How?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for helping me answer your question. A property owner of a manufactured home park wants to sell for whatever reason. May have gotten a cold call from a developer. Maybe the owner died and the children don't want to own a manufactured home park. But so it's now on the market. Those parks sell pretty quickly. You've taken, over the last several years, you've taken several steps to enable tenants to compete For example, something called opportunity to purchase that you all passed in 2014, so the residents can compete. We have some other financial tools that enable residents to fund a purchase. But what a housing authority, or in this case, or CASA, which enable works with the residents to buy a park, or St. Vincent de Paul would do, would be to go to the seller, the owner of the park, and say, you're asking to sell this park for X dollars. I can't pay X dollars, but I can pay you X minus something dollars, and you can get a capital gains exemption break, which will lower the price, but the effective return for you would be competitive. Maybe not as much, but it would be competitive. Many of the parks that are in the state are owned by moms and pops who actually like the idea of enabling their residents to stay there. Because if it sells to some other entity, it may well be closed, developed for something else, or the rents, the trend tends to be that national entities that own these parks raise the rents significantly. So it's a win for the state in terms of preserving an affordable housing tool. And we don't think the cost to the state is a huge amount of money. But anyway, the buyer, the nonprofit or CDC buyer, can say to the seller, lower your price, offset your lowered price with your capital gains exemption so that your effective return is close, at least. I flunked tax law, so I'm not the person here to tell you about taxes. But that's roughly the concept.
The way you pass tax law is to recognize that taxes don't make sense. You just have to learn them.
I never thought I would be talking about tax law when I was in law school.
Thank you. Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just curious to know exactly how much of a return we get on the state's investment, because obviously the state is always going to be putting up the lost amount of tax, but I don't know if that's the exact amount of reduction in price. So I'm just curious about the experience there.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, I'd have to actually get some real numbers to say that. But this would be the only investment that the state makes in these, at least in the manufactured home parks. The model that we've got going now, based on something we copied from New Hampshire, doesn't require any other public investment in those parks. It's a one-time to enable the sale. And it's working beautifully for those parks. Whether it would work in apartment buildings, we don't really know yet.
Do you have a mom-and-pops apartment owners in the situation that we're describing that are currently low-cost housing, but they're about to go off, and they might have some of the same motivations as the mom-and-pop owners of mobile home parks, or do you know?
Absolutely. I'm in negotiations now with a property owner who owns three properties in the Mid-Valley. She's in her 80s.
Oh, that was your example?
That's an example in the letter. You know, she's a widow. She's most concerned about trying to figure out her estate, and taxes are a pressing concern of hers. She is also in negotiations with some for-profit buyers. We'd like to have that incentive to offer her in as part of our package. And then we would package that financing and make a commitment to affordability for generations into the future. And she does have that motivation of wanting to make sure her residents aren't displaced. She is a sweet, feisty old gal and has a lot of fondness for her residents and a deep interest in their future, but is also trying to figure out how to manage her estate.
Yes, thank you. Yes, Representative Woodson.
Thank you. I'm just still trying to understand this. So would these only be already existing low-income apartments that you're talking about, or would we be looking at the possibility of displacing middle-class tenants by changing it to a low-income-only apartment?
Representative Barnhart and Wisnett, most often the financing package for an affordable housing property would include federal funds that would have a very stringent requirement on displacement, so avoiding any displacement. The result of that is that I would only look at properties where the tenant population is already low income, but where they are vulnerable to rising rents. As you know, in some markets right now, when ownership shifts, we've seen a dynamic of the new owner coming in and evicting everybody in the building, and then slapping a little paint on and raising the rent substantially. This would actually be a kind of preventative measure to that, to be able to go to that seller and say, let me buy your property, give you this little tax benefit, and now I will commit that it will be affordable for decades to come. So, again, a little different twist. I think you could use it in either scenario. I don't see a scenario where you would come in to a property that already has middle-income kind of rental rates. You would want to come into a property that has currently affordable rates and a currently low and moderate income population.
Because of the federal requirement.
Because the federal requirements for relocation are upon displacement.
I just wondered if that's in the bill. I think you probably need to point that out, because if you get apartment owners looking at this as a way to offset their taxes and you don't have that in the bill, you could end up with a situation where you displace, say, lower middle class people for the low income people. I mean, I just think you really need to be careful about not assuming, or that you aren't going to do it. Somebody else may not have your feelings about it. So
I would note, Chair Barnhart, Representative Witz, that we're talking about sales only to community development corporations, which are defined in statute. They can only use their resources for charitable purposes, or housing authorities, which are also defined in statute, can only use their resources for certain things. So those are the only two entities that could purchase this and create the exemption.
Representative Vance, and I think Representative Kenny Geyer wants to be heard, so can we bring her up?
No, yes.
Representative Vance has a question before you get away, but Representative Kenny Geyer, do you want to come to the table? She may want to answer some of these questions herself.
So I'm still on the same point I was on earlier, and that is that the amount of capital gains tax is 9.9% or whatever it is, and the assumption is that somehow the price will automatically ratchet down by that amount, and that's not how I think it works. And so is it right that that amount is, if I were to pay it, deductible off my federal taxes? If it's not, I don't remember the rule there, but if it is, then that further reduces the, we're going to be paying the 10%, but the value to the person who's actually using it may be something else, maybe something considerably less than 10%. So now, having done these deals before, there's a lot of slack many times in the pricing of these units, and many different things going on in them, many different, a lot of craziness has been my experience. And and to be able to say that this particular element of the deal is the one that causes it to happen would be, in some cases, quite a reach. But in other words, I think it's a free ride situation, and I'm not sure the exact amount we're investing and the exact return that we're getting. And so this goes back really to the chair's question about actually seeing how it really has worked and what the cost is to us on the one hand and the benefit to low-income folks on the other.
So maybe you do need to get the numbers that I was saying maybe you didn't need, but I think perhaps you do need to get them. Representative Kenny Geyer?
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer, State Representative for House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. Thank you for letting me jump in, because I'm in a health committee that's working a bunch of bills, so I feel like I'm plopping in the middle and I missed the beginning of what you had to say. But what I wanted to say is the Chair of the Human Services and Housing Committee, the lack of affordable housing, as we all know, is a huge crisis. And besides looking at how do we do some modest protections for tenants in that situation, we all know that we really have to get on top of the supply, because we're in such a whacked out market right now because of the huge gap in supply and demand. So I think of it as three kind of buckets that we're working on simultaneously. One is, how do we preserve affordable housing that's already there? A second is, how do you convert market rate housing into the affordable housing bucket? And a third is constructing affordable housing. So this one I think of as the middle bucket. How do you convert what might be market rate housing over to affordable housing if somebody is wanting to sell? And I would not think it would be a high end, because it would be too unaffordable for a group like Martha's to come in and buy if it's really high end. It's probably some kind of low-end kind of deteriorating building. But it's also preserving affordable housing, because often these are apartment buildings that have had the HUD contracts and they've expired after 30 years. And I went to go visit 2 weeks ago on Southeast Hawthorne and 15th, a building that Simpson Properties, which is a property management company around the country, had been managing this property. That it was built in 1982. I'm going to make up some numbers. I know that they bought it 2 years ago for $6 million, and I'm going to assume, for the purpose of simplicity, that it was built for maybe $1 million in 1982. So the capital gains, since they paid $6 million 2 years ago, would have been on the $5 million increase. I'm saying that for simplicity. I don't know if it was exactly $1 million. If this law passed and Martha knew that Simpson property were to sell to her and save the capital gains, that's basically saving $500,000. So she could come in and say, instead of offering $6 million, which is the market price, I can offer you $5.5 million. So it does a couple of things. It helps us start converting, either preserving the affordable housing we have or converting market rate into affordable bucket, because we need to increase that bucket. But it also, we know that some of the people who have been living here for 20 or 30 years, it's not just the roof over their head, and where else are we going to put them? This is a community for them. So it gives another tool to affordable housing agencies just to have leverage. Will private property managers always do that? Maybe not. Will she choose to want to enter into that sale? Maybe not. It's just a tool. We're looking everywhere we can to give affordable housing agencies more tools. So that's really it. I probably won't stay in, because I know Mitch was like, don't be gone for long. So I know you can answer more questions than I can. But I do want to say this also came out, and I don't know if you said this, came out of the ABC, the A Better Choice Housing group that got together with under the leadership of Representative Parrish and Representative Reardon a couple years ago. This was one of the ideas that came to the table in a bipartisan support. My Human Service, it's a committee bill from my committee, and it was unanimously supported. So I just wanted to add that to the discussion. They are way better on the details than I am.
Thank you so much. Okay, we really appreciate it.
I'm sorry to take off the dock fee, because that was part of this bucket over here of actually increasing construction. We haven't quite gotten agreement on that, but I'm really passionate about finding every source of any tool, any source of funding to increase affordable housing. So I hope that we'll revisit that next year. But it'll be amended out of this bill.
Yes, we've already discussed it. We're talking about the dash one we haven't got yet.
Okay, all right. Great. I'm happy to circle back and answer questions later.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I still have two more witnesses on this bill, and we have another bill to go. Are there further burning questions for this panel? Thank you so much. Let's hear from Janet Byrd and Jody Weiser, please. Is there anyone else who really, really wants to be heard today? Okay, come forward, please. Janet, let's hear from you first.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Janet Byrd. I'm the Director of Neighborhood Partnerships and the convener of the Oregon Housing Alliance. The earlier panel made many of the points that I would want to make. Sorry, my voice. I think what I would add, and I will certainly work with them to come back with the answers to the questions that you've raised. I think the one thing that I would add in talking to both owners of small private properties spread throughout the state, as well as folks who've had experience with the manufactured home park exemption that parallels this, is that it's so hard to calculate what the impact of the capital gains tax break would be. It all depends on sale price, how long somebody's held the property, as you know, Representative Bentz, as well as how aggressive they've been in accelerating depreciation. But what folks expressed to me, the real benefit to this is that it's going to bring someone to the table to negotiate, enter into a conversation about a sale. It may be enough to keep them patient enough to work with a nonprofit or a housing authority as that entity assembles the resources, assembling the public funds, the private funds, the other resources that are necessary for an acquisition. And so it's really that sweetener to the deal. We can certainly work on figuring out what the actual cash impact to the state budget would be, but it's getting folks to the table and engaged in a conversation, and then encouraging them to be patient as the deal gets worked out. That folks expressed to me the benefit of this would be.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Ms. Weiser, please.
Representative Barnhart and members of the committee. I share the concerns that Representative Whitsitt and Benz have expressed. I have a friend who owns multiple buildings from Portland to Eugene and is quite unwilling to pay taxes. So I raised with him the question of how this would look to him. And he immediately created a spreadsheet and knew which buildings it would be a great deal because he could probably sell for, you know, $100,000 less than asking price and save himself $900,000 worth of taxes. So it started me on the path of creating the examples that are part of my testimony. And there are cases where the public would probably get a good deal, and there are cases where the public wouldn't. And there's no reason the seller would have to tell the public, that the people they're negotiating with, well, what did I pay? You can find that out. What do I want to sell it for? You can find that out. But you don't know how much they've depreciated the asset, how much they've added to the asset, what their gain really is going to be. You can assume they're in the highest tax bracket. And his first question was, well, is this for federal and state taxes or just for state taxes? You could see it, the gleam in his eye from the idea. And so our proposal is really you should look at how much you want to subsidize housing. Know how much you want to subsidize housing because the money is coming out of the general fund, whether it comes out before you receive it or after you receive it. And the same deal where you're really not going to know as the purchaser at the housing authority whether this person is getting a $100,000 tax break or a $900,000 tax break. If you say we're willing to pay the price you're asking of everyone because we can get this grant from the state for the whatever the amount it is, then we really know we're in the bargaining seat instead of they are. We do hear that argument. It's a conversation opener. You hear that argument with economic development benefits all the time as well. But what that means is we don't know what we're paying for what we get. And I think that surely housing is a big problem and it deserves a piece of the general fund. But we should give it how much we want to give it out of the general fund instead of saying, here's some money that you can choose how much you spend. We don't know how much it will be. We'll probably never find out how much it cost us. Because it's just going to happen outside the realm of any kind of control.
Thank you.
And so that concerns
us. I note that you've submitted testimony, and I would commend the committee to the second page of the Tax Fairness Oregon testimony. The first part actually refers to the part of the bill you like, which apparently we're not going to do, and right. the part that you don't like, you actually included several examples on the second page, which I find enlightening, which I would commend to the committee. Is there some other topic that you'd like to raise on this one? Thank you. Now, I suspect this is a good segue to the department because I think I know what you're going to say. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and we just would ask for some technical fixes to define what the term amounts received is. I think based on the testimony that I've heard today, you're talking about the gain that's included in federal taxable income, but amounts received is vague as defined, and it's actually not defined, and it could mean literally 100% of the sales price, which I don't think is based on the testimony we've heard today what the intent is. So we would ask for some clarifying language around that, as well as some way to certify or verify that the sale was properly done for our administrative purposes.
Thank you. Is that another way of seconding what Ms. Weiser said about being unable to tell what the exact amounts we're talking about are, or are you actually raising a different point?
We would just want to be able to, Mr. Chair, know when we see the tax return, know that the subtraction that's claimed on the Oregon return was to a qualifying organization upon audit. So there has to be some sort of certification process in the record that says that it was sold to a qualifying organization. So some sort of record that way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4043 and open the public hearing on House Bill 4063. Are you on that one, too? Okay. Give us a description, and we'll hear from Mr. Potowski, Tim Cowan and Marcia Kelly first come forward while she gives us the summary, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4063 would change the distribution of the kicker to an even distribution between each individual and spouse who filed a return in the year directly prior to the year in which an excess from the forecast is determined. And so instead of being, as it currently is, distributed according to the proportional tax liability that the taxpayer had, it would be more just evenly distributed amongst all filers in the state.
Thank you. Colleagues, in the interest of transparency, I'll note that this was my bill. I introduced it partly because I've gotten tired of waiting around for the opportune moment to repeal this completely insane mechanism that we have in our tax law called the kicker. And instead, it made sense to me to distribute the kicker evenly because it comes up at times when, for a whole variety of reasons, there usually is a recession, and it makes sense to give it to the people who would actually spend the money and stimulate the economy rather than those who would invest it in the stock market. And I hope I didn't steal your thunder. Please, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Tom Patowski. I'm director of the Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State University, but I come to you today as a citizen and a former state economist for Oregon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, back in 1999, Paul Warner was encouraging me to consider the position of state economist, and at that time he had, I guess it would be a memory lapse, he never told me about the kicker and what it meant for the position of state economist. And I won't go into the details of why I feel the kicker.
This is before you accepted the job.
This is before I accepted the job.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Now we get it.
The problems with the kicker, but I try my best to make something good out of the kicker. So when I would go to conferences where economists would be at, I could always be assured that somebody at the conference would buy me a drink after they heard the story about the kicker. It was a sad story. Now, they wouldn't buy one right away because they didn't believe that the kicker actually existed, and I'd have to go to the website of LRO and show them that it was actually true. So I want to try to make something good out of the kicker, and I think in many ways House Bill 4063 tries to make something good out of the kicker. Let me just quickly describe in a very simple way. You know, the way it kind of works right now is, let's say we have two people. One person is paying $30 in taxes. Another person is paying $70. So total tax liability is $100. And then we find out that, oh, the revenues were higher than the forecast by more than 2%, and $10 of that $100 is considered the personal kicker. So we go back and we say that $10 is 10% of the total $100. So the person that paid in 30, they get 10% back on that, so they get their tax liability reduced by $3. The person that was making 70, they're also 10%, so that's $7 less. So then it's rather than paying in 70, they pay in 63. All right, and that $7 and $3 make up the total amount of the kicker, the $10. Now, this bill changes that just slightly and says, well, let's consider it as almost a sort of a dividend, something like the Alaska permanent fund dividend, and do it equally by the people so that the person A and B, now they each get $5. So previously the $30 person now gets to deduct 5 instead of 3. The $70 person, instead of deducting 7, they only deduct 5. And so effectively what you do is you've used the kicker on a one-time basis here to change the effective tax rate. The effective tax rate on the person that paid in the $30 gets lowered, and the effective tax rate on the $70 person still gets lowered, but not as lowered as much as it did under the old system. So I think it's an opportunity to sort of use this, if we look at it as a dividend, to redistribute the kicker back, and a opportunity to, in a sense, lower the effective tax rate on generally lower income people. It's not always the case, but it's generally who's going to pay the lower tax liabilities as opposed to the higher income group. Both groups still get a deduction in their tax rates, but one benefits more, the lower income buys the higher income one. Now, there's many shades of what's equitable and fair. The feeling is that, heck, if I paid in more to my taxes, shouldn't I get more back? But you know, I look at the kicker here as, well, if it truly is a surplus and it's the state involved completely, well, let's treat it like maybe Alaska does. It's a dividend. And one way to distribute that back, as I said, many shapes and forms of what's equitable and fair, is to do it on an equal basis. And I'll leave my comments at that.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, committee members, for the record, my name is Tim Cowan. To the bill, Section 1, where it talks about administrative services, will provide the Legislative Revenue Office an estimate of what the revenue is going to be. My issue is student debt. When I graduated from college, I had no student debt, so that meant I immediately contributed to the economy. Bought a car in a year, bought a house in about 3 years. President of Western Oregon said about 2 weeks ago that it takes 10 years for a student to pay off their student debt. So I think that delays the economic value that those students can provide. I would just like to see that be included in the estimate of their revenue when they take a look at college students. One last thing, if I may, Chair. I'm looking at right now trying to get college-reduced expenses initially by looking at maybe completing part of the year, freshman year in high school, and get rid of iteration that's occurring. And there are a number of states now that have a college degree in 3 years.
Great. Thank you very much. Marcia?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Marcia Kelly with the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, and then I'll tag on the HISCO position at the end of my testimony for Oregon Women's Rights. I agree with both the chair and the esteemed former state economist that the kicker is insane. We have a policy to get rid of it. Lacking getting rid of it, this bill would be good in that it would allow the distribution of the monies to go directly to people who would probably spend the money in the state rather than adding to their equity position or taking a trip. If the estimated figures are right, more people in the top, in the bottom 80% would receive a benefit than the 20% of the highest income people. The figures that I have is somewhere around $200. That doubles if you have a joint return because it's per person, so that would be $400. For families with their average income of $45,000 or lower for the state. So it would put money back in those pockets, and it would also be money that would most likely be spent in the local economies, in Bend and Heppner, in Baker City, in John Day, and
even Ontario, I suspect.
I tried to be a little careful about that. I didn't even say Burns, because I know that but those dollars in those smaller economies makes a lot of difference compared to some extent to the economy of, say, Washington County, where the average income because of Intel is much higher. And so this bill, by tweaking the way that we distribute the money back, would benefit the Oregonians who are struggling to keep up with the increase in the cost in the economy, have not reaped the benefit of the fact that Oregon is really gaining in its financial wealth.
Thank you very much. Question.
And HISCO, I have to say HISCO.
Oh, yes, please.
HISCO has always had a position to get rid of the kicker, but we would also agree that if we're not going to get rid of the kicker, this income distribution will help most of the clients that HISCO members serve.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? President Vance, please.
Thank you. So it seems to me, and I'll ask Dr. Potowski this question, that we're mixing two concepts. The first one is the kicker is at its heart an income or a spending limitation device, as I've studied over the years. The concept being that we're going to establish a lid, and to the extent that income to the state exceeds that amount, it'll be returned. So in all of my discussions with constituents and others, the question when we talk about the kicker has been, what are you going to replace it with, Representative? Because the concept is we don't want you spending more than you already are. So there's one issue. The other issue is income inequality, which is quite different. Mm-hmm. And so the what's going on in this idea here is, one, pointing at the kicker and saying how bad it is, and then the next breath saying we're going to spend it to address a real issue, which indeed is real, income inequality. So how would you recommend that we address the first issue first? And that is, if the kicker is going to be redirected, as this bill would suggest, what do we do about the argument that we have not addressed at all limiting our spending?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, those are both very good questions and issues. That means I needed a moment to think about the response. But the first one, look, you as a group, right now, what happens essentially is that you've decided as a group, for better or for worse, that you have the spending responsibility of a drunken sailor. And we need to have this kicker law to keep you the spending limit to happen. But what you've essentially done is you've taken away from yourselves the ability to have these discussions among yourself and setting whatever limits you wanted to set. Instead, you give it to a state economist on a forecast, and if the forecast is wrong, that's how a spending limit is set. So you've been able to do it with the rainy day funds and being able to put funds away and so on. I would think as a collective body, and you retain your ability and do right over financing and don't give it to this sort of kicker process, I think you probably could find a way to do it. And I don't know what that is, but I would think that would be the better way to find a spending limit than the process through the kicker, for one. But whatever that might be, I'm not sure exactly how that would work. The second one with income inequality, this may address it somewhat. What I'm seeing it more as is an opportunity to say, okay, let's try to lessen the burden on those of lower income relative to those of higher income. Go ahead.
I spent the weekend, oddly enough, reading a couple of books on income inequality. No lie, I did. And that's one of the virtues of having no life and spending one's weekends in Salem.
In Salem.
The focus on...
And you'll share those titles with us.
I'm happy to do
that. Oh, good.
Yeah,
thank you.
One is called The Great Divergence, and I've forgotten the name of the other one. The point is that in those analyses, the income inequality isn't generally found in places like Oregon or maybe a couple of our residents. It's in the top 0.1%. That's where the view of the inequality is. I would suggest that when we talk about the kicker, we're not talking over a very, very small, very modest number that fit in that particular equation. So I'm saying this is, if anything, a really modest swing at repairing income inequality. But maybe I'm wrong.
No, Representative Bentz, I agree with that. I mean, this is not going to do anything really to income inequality to any great degree. I mean, the kicker is it happens probably more often than it should, but it's not a permanent type of aspect that is going to over time affect income inequality, and it's generally of a dollar amount that is not very large. I mean, some of it will have definitely implications for people of lower income because a dollar is, in a sense, has a higher worth for them than a higher income person in terms of their spending capability. But you're right, it's not going to really change income inequality. It gives some slight relief in terms of a tax liability to lower income relative to higher income.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Witsit, please. Yeah.
I have a couple things. First of all, isn't Alaska's dividend from oil and gas royalties? Mm-hmm. It's not from individuals who have paid taxes. It's from royalties paid to the state by, that's my understanding, in your example. So to me, we're looking at apples and oranges. One is what we're talking about here is from the state and its individuals working and paying taxes. The other is royalties paid to the state by or for state resources that were essentially mined from it. Okay, and then I'm trying to understand the kicker was a constitutional amendment. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is in the Constitution.
Okay,
yes, that's correct.
So since I'm not really that familiar with it, is the distribution defined within the Constitution, or how would we be able to change a constitutional amendment without the majority, a supermajority?
Yeah, let me talk about that one because I think that's an important one. The constitutional amendment does not define how the money is to be returned to the taxpayer. It simply says that it is to be returned. And I think it says according to law. There is a legislative council opinion that suggests that the court might very well decide that the current distribution system was mandated when that amendment was adopted. I have to say I think that's ridiculous and ludicrous because it's not in the amendment and it doesn't say anything in the amendment about a limitation on the way in which it's distributed back to taxpayers, simply that it is to be. So if this bill were to be adopted, one of the things that would have to be in it would be a quick review process, as we've done it on other occasions when the constitutionality of an issue was being questioned, to avoid having to pay the kicker twice, a kicker refund twice. It's not going to apply this year. I mean, if we passed it today and the Senate passed it tomorrow, it would still not apply to the kicker that's coming as part of the as a tax credit this year. It would apply to some future years. But what you'd have to do is build a special jurisdiction in the Supreme Court so that if somebody were to sue, it would be litigated before the tax credit would be applied against tax returns so that we'd know for sure. And I know that's a longer answer than you wanted, but the short answer to your question is no, it's not in the Constitution. There is some, then the slightly longer answer is there is some question as to whether it's covered anyway. And the even longer question answer is the one I gave you about a jurisdiction in the Supreme Court so that they could actually figure this out before the money had actually been paid out. That could easily be done. I will say that I assumed that this bill was going to be an item for conversation rather than a bill we were going to pass this session. Although, if you think otherwise, I'd be perfectly happy to get those amendments drafted and get it out.
I have a question regarding that. Since I'm not a lawyer, would someone have to show harm before you could bring the case forward to the Supreme Court?
Well, the harm, of course, would be that next year I'm going to get $200 rather than the $45,000 I was expecting to get. That's my harm. And so I could sue on the grounds that I was not getting the amount that the constitutional amendment said I should get, and then the questions before the court is the statute that the legislature just passed muster or doesn't it? Now, one of the things that was pointed out to me yesterday, or maybe it was this morning, was that we've already made changes in the distribution method in 2007 when we passed a bill that treated tax credits differently than they'd been treated before, the effect of which was to increase slightly the progressivity of the tax of the refund. So this is simply a larger increase in the progressivity, as it were, which I think, of course, is a great lawyer's argument. But frankly, I have no idea what the Supreme Court would say. The fact that LC disagrees with me about this topic is some evidence, at least, that the court might not agree with me. Yeah. Representative Davis, did you want to comment on that? I didn't think so. Okay. I did get the explanation reasonably close, I think, to what they said and what my own views are about it. If a Supreme Court, if a constitutional amendment automatically drags along a whole set of statutes with it, that's news to me. And it shouldn't be assumed that it does that. Yes, please.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bentz, I would not consider the kicker a spending limitation. I would consider the kicker a crazy law that just has the economist making a projection. In 2001, in House Bill 3997, we replaced Oregon's spending limitation with a percentage of personal income with some so there is actually a spending limitation for the state. It's not in the Constitution, I do not believe.
Thank you. And I simply note that that's one of those areas where two people look at the same policy and have completely different explanations for it.
Well, it pays to actually have been going to Revenue Committee meetings since 2001, Representative Bentz. So there are other people who have no lives either.
For whatever that's worth. Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much. We appreciate it, your testimony. Mr. Groner, Ms. Kearney? And Chuck Sheketoff, please. Oh, thank you. While they're coming up, let me remind the members that the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee has graciously invited us to attend their meeting at 8:30 on Wednesday morning to hear the current state economist give his next revenue projection. I know some of you have committee meetings at that time and will not be able to attend. I will be there. Some of the rest of you ought to come if you can. I think you'll find it enlightening. And I think that's as much as I'll say about that. Wednesday morning, 8:30, in this room, the meeting of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. We'll hear from the state economist on his March forecast. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came in especially to see if my voice is back. It was gone for 4 days. And I'm here to just, Ralph Groner, representing AFSCME, do the best I can to just say I support your comments and I support Tom's comments. And I really think any time we can help seniors on fixed incomes and veterans and people who need, I don't care if it's 10 bucks a month, what they're calling me about in my county, the seniors still do, is, Ralph, I'm getting increased cost on everything in my home I own. I'm not sure I can afford to stay in my home. So if this helped a little bit to you, it's a lot to them. So we support it wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Josie Kerner with Tax Fairness Oregon. And we are in agreement with your views and those of Tom's. And I'll be very quick because a lot of it's been said already. But we believe that every taxpayer paid their fair share of taxes, and the amounts received above the economist's expectation belong to the state as a whole and not to these individual taxpayers. In the best of all worlds, we wouldn't see this revenue kicker money at all, but rather as money to spend or to save in a rainy day fund for years of when we have revenue shortfalls. Instead, the legislature is left with a decision about how to distribute this revenue to taxpayers in the ways they believe best benefit the state as a whole. A distribution formula on contributions paid is best for the wealthy, but provides the least benefit to the state, as the funds tend to end up in equity investments or travel abroad rather than local spending. Moderate and lower income citizens tend to spend bonus money on new tires, local entertainment, dental visits, and the like, which better serves both the people and the economy of the state. TFO believes that distribution based on the population that includes all the tax filers and their dependents would be best for our economy and our citizens. As we were preparing our testimony, it occurred to us that if the state's sponsored retirement savings accounts were ready to roll, this would be an alternative that would be equally good, and it's a good idea, but it's too soon for that. So thank you for your cooperation.
Thank you very much. And now we're about to learn another new thing, I think.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Chuck Sheketoff, the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I'm here in opposition to this legislation. I think it's well-intentioned by the chair and others, and I certainly appreciate your interest. If it's going to kick while we're in a recession, it ought to go to those who will spend it immediately. But it's really what I would say is putting perfume on a pig, and this is what I mean by that. The kicker is very misunderstood. In fact, a state economist, former state economist, said, well, if it truly is a surplus, it's not a surplus. We have the kicker because a state economist, with advice of other economists, has to meet an impossible standard, project the economy 2 months out within 2%.
2 years?
Two years out, excuse me. More than 2 years out, 25 months out, the way it works with the May forecast. And so it's an impossible standard to meet. It would be sort of like if Representative Barnhart were invited to Thanksgiving at Representative Bence's home in Ontario, and he said, okay, when you're eating, we're sitting down right at 6. I'd like you to get there right when we sit down. I don't want you to mingle with my family. And Representative Barnhart said, okay, I'll do that. I'll be there at 6. And he got there 3 minutes early. You'd penalize him. You'd say, oh, you don't get dessert or something. It's an impossible standard for Representative Barnhart to guess it down to the minute of when he would get to Ontario. I don't think the state economist can guess the economy 25 months out with a 2% margin. And history proves me right. So it's so misunderstood. I think what this does is that people don't know it's a pig. It's got so much makeup on it. It's this great thing. They think it's a spending limit. They think it's surplus. They think they overpay taxes. No, you're just making it smell nice, right? You're going to give more to a whole bunch of people, and it's people I care about very deeply, as you know, low-income and middle-income Oregonians. But it's just reinforcing this bad idea. Oregon's revenue problems that you have to address and that your associates in the Ways and Means process have to address is adequacy and stability. And we need adequate funds, and they sometimes overlap when we're going into a recession and we're giving out the kicker, making it even more unstable, as happened by $1 billion last time. And so the way to get stability is to build a rainy day fund. And that's ought to happen. I mean, I would welcome this committee putting in a bill to say, you know, if Measure 28 passes, let's right now preemptively dedicate a percentage of that to our rainy day fund, because that's what we need. We need more money in the rainy day fund. We don't need the kicker. I think it was between the 2007 and 9 session, there was the Revenue Restructuring Task Force that Representative Shetterly was one of the co-chairs of, and at the City Club on Friday he referred to it and talked about that was their conclusion of studying what to do, and it was pretty remarkable. I was a non-voting member of the commission study group, but it's pretty remarkable from where they began to where they ended that the end result was we ought to do kicker reform. We need to – stabilities are an issue. We need to build up the rainy day fund. And that's what's needed. So, you know, I don't think you should reinforce people's views of a item that they don't understand well, that they think is surplus, they think they overpay taxes and all that. I think you should put your energies between now and the 17th session into looking at making our system more stable and dealing with the realities of the kicker. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? For some of you who have not been on this committee until recently, you're getting a reprise of old conversations. There should be echoes across out the walls about these conversations. That doesn't mean they're less germane now than they were in 2007 or 2001. I will note that in 2002, we paid out a kicker, or at the end of 2001, we paid out a kicker of $250 million. Next month or the month after, we borrowed $250 million at the beginning of 2002, and by the end of by the middle of the session in 2003, we borrowed another $500 million just to balance the budget. In 2007, we paid out $1 billion in a kicker, personal kicker, and in 2008, the only thing that saved us was payment from the federal government, 2009 rather, payment from the federal government of well over $1 billion to supplement our school funding and other funding. And then finally the problem hit us with full force in the next biennium. So it is exactly as Mr. Sheketoff says, it's a huge problem for us. The difference, I think, between his views and mine at this moment, if I can speak for us together, is that I've given up on the idea that we're actually going to fix this thing. He hasn't. And so maybe you should listen to him instead of to me. Any other questions? Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony. Anything else for the good of the order today? Thank you for indulging me in staying a few minutes late. Committee, we meet next Wednesday, not tomorrow, Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Please come at 8:30, those who are able on Wednesday morning, to listen to the current holder of that august office that Tom Petowski and our own Paul Warner previously held. And with that, committee, the hearing is closed, and the committee is adjourned.